Now to a reporter who covers Donald Trump every day and who made headlines early this year when he interviewed the president and was treated with great respect, which doesn't always happen. He's Gary O'Donoghue, the BBC's chief North America correspondent, who goes by the social media handle Blind Gazza because he lost his sight at the age of 8. One of the reasons why Gary got that interview was because he was in Butler, Pennsylvania, the day that Donald Trump survived the assassination attempt.
We're pointing at the guy crawling up the roof.
And he had a gun, right?
He had a rifle.
A rifle.
We could clearly see him with a rifle. Absolutely. We're pointing at him. The police are down there running around on the ground. We're like, hey, man, there's a guy on the roof with a rifle.
He's on the ground reporting quite literally at times because bullets were obviously flying. Won in this year's Royal Television Society Award for covering breaking news. I caught up with him yesterday afternoon. Hey, Gary, it's lovely to have you in Sydney.
Great pleasure to be here. Lovely to see you again.
Before we talk about your interview with Donald Trump, let's just deal with the news of the week, that new national security strategy and the rupture with Europe, its support for patriotic parties of the hard and far right. You're a keen student of US history, Gary. How big a deal do you think this new articulation of the Trump doctrine actually is?
Well, I think this sort of tension between America and the old world, as they like to call places like Europe, has been there for some time, hasn't it? It's been sort of growing over a period of time. We've had various presidents before Trump talking about pivots to Asia and all that kind of thing. But I think there is a sort of an increasing frustration in the Trump presidency about Europe not really falling into line. They kind of want two contradictory things at times. They want Europe to be, you know, to stand on its own two feet, have its own strategic autonomy. But at the same time, when it acts as one like that, you know, and there's been increasing signs of that over things like Ukraine, Washington doesn't really like it. The fragmentation works to Washington's advantage, even though the public rhetoric says it wants Europe to step up and do its own thing.
As a BBC correspondent, you spend a lot of time reporting on the Transatlantic Alliance and the Western Alliance. This new strategy is very Kremlin-friendly. It's very Farage-friendly. It's very AfD-friendly, this far-right outfit in Germany that's enjoying such success at the moment. Should countries like Britain and Australia freak out? I mean, both of those countries have centre-left governments.
I think they won't, whether they should or not, because I think there's still a view, and you certainly hear this in London, and I'm sure it's true in other capitals in Europe, there's still a view that this might end, that, you know, the limitations, the constitutional limitations, etc., means that this period of what people would describe as sort of instability, a fracture, of kind of hostility even between Washington and its traditional allies will come to an end. Now, that could well be wishful thinking. It will depend on lots of things, not least whether someone can kind of inherit the kind of MAGA crown in a sort of effective way, whether it's utterly and completely tied to the individual in the shape of Donald Trump. But I think that's what they're hoping. And so they're kind of holding their breath. They've been holding their breath for years in these European capitals, waiting for this to pass. And so I think you will get, as you always get with, you know, things like Keir Starmer in Britain, a really muted reaction to any of these more kind of extreme positions, a kind of, well, that's Donald, you know, but we're doing our own thing. And they have learned a kind of vocabulary and a behaviour that doesn't bring them into direct conflict when these sorts of things come along.
Let's talk about your interview with Donald Trump that took place back in July.
I'm here with the president. Here you go.
Mr. President.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm very well, sir. Thank you very much for sparing some time.
Good. You covered us very fairly. Appreciate it.
Well, I wanted to ask you briefly about that to start with. I know it's not a topic.
I mean, Gary, there's a lovely backstory to what happened in that moment and beforehand.
It's something I've been working on for quite a long time, trying to make this happen. And I'd explored various, as you know, you have to sort of use the channels you've got. And I'd done this. And I didn't actually think it was going to happen. We had a couple of false starts over the previous weekend where we were told he was going to call. And we'd like set up in an office where we were going to film my end of the call, right? And so we had like a proper camera person and a VJ. Video journalist. And we were going to do like a sort of really something really fancy. And like we did a rehearsal and someone said, okay, we're going to film your phone screen when it lights up. And I'd renamed the number I knew it was going to come come from as, you know, the president. And my ringtone, my ringtone is a theme from Succession. And when this came on, the producer said, we cannot have that. We cannot have that. Think people will think that's really deliberate and we're trying to make a meme. So they forced me to change the ringtone on my phone.
Calling editorial.
But anyway, you know, this, it didn't happen a couple of times. We were told it was going to happen from AF1 at one point. Again, we were set up. Didn't happen. And a couple of days passed and I was at home one evening. I confess, having a little doze on the sofa, and the phone rings, and it's the press secretary saying, I've got the president on the line, here you go. And I thought, oh my goodness. And I hung up. I accidentally hung up.
You hung up on the president of the United States.
The president of the United States. Unfortunately, they rang back. By which time I'd scrambled off the sofa, got to my desk, and I was sort of carrying a digital recorder around me, you know, for weeks in case it happened. And then it happened, and all the kind of fancy plans about videoing one end. I ended up recording it like we used to record the charts off the radio in the 70s, you know, ambient from the phone call on speakerphone.
Fantastic. What was striking about the interview was that we got a different Donald Trump. It felt like a friendly chit-chat. And because of that, I think you probably got more out of him. He was a bit more reflective. He was a bit more candid.
Possibly. I mean, for others to say and all that. But it was the end of the day. He was on his own in the Oval with the press secretary, no one else. I think I was lucky and I caught him in a kind of a mood. He'd obviously had some background about me. I don't know how much. He had an idea of who I was, which is not always the case. Largely not the case as foreign media, as you know. And I thought I was going to get 5 minutes. So, you know, I'm kind of constantly thinking, God, you know, how am I going to squeeze in everything to 5 minutes? But it goes on and on. And there was a moment during the call where he wanted to talk off the record about a couple of things. And so we did that for a few minutes. But it went on for 20 minutes or so, all told. You know, and there are there's definitely some things I missed. You know, I didn't get round to talking about Gaza particularly, which is, you know, something I, you know, wish I had time to do. But I just tried to... I mean, I do what I try and do most of the time with interviews, which is leave the spaces. So when there are gaps, you don't have to jump in. And particularly with people like Donald Trump, they fill the gaps for you. Hmm. So one of the pitfalls of some of the interviews that happen with Trump is that people are kind of at it, you know, they feel they have to be at it. They don't sit back and they don't listen. And, you know, I think on that occasion, at any rate, we were lucky enough to get a little bit more. I don't think we got any stunning lines, if I'm absolutely honest with you. I mean, there were some moments and there were some things he didn't take the bait on, particularly in relation to the UK, which, you know, obviously I was trying for. But it was a big moment for the BBC in the sense that, you know, that's, we hadn't had an interview with a sitting president for 10 years of any kind.
Yeah.
And again, that's part of the function of being foreign media, even in an organisation as big as the BBC. So it was good for the organisation. And, oh, Nick, I got to the end of the interview and I'm thinking, shit, did I actually press record? And like, I had this moment where I thought, what do I do if it didn't record? Do I actually tell anyone that it happened even? And so
a tree falling in a forest.
A tree falling, exactly. No one there to perceive it. Was that Bishop Barclay? Anyway, yeah, so I rang my producer who lives in the same block as I do and I said, you've got to come up. I just need to show. This is a secret between you and me. And we checked and it was there. And then we spent all night putting it together, versioning it for TV, radio, online, blah, 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 and rolled it out.
Gary, one of the reasons you got that interview with Donald Trump was because you were in Butler, Pennsylvania, on the day that Trump was almost assassinated. Your reporting won plaudits. Your reporting has won prizes. Take me back to that day.
Do you know, it was a peculiar day. It was a what we call a send, you know, a decision to go to this thing that we were quite keen to do, me and my team, and the bosses weren't that keen at all because it was the day before the RNC, the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, and it was, you know, in the sort of rural Pennsylvania, 4 hours from DC. But I pushed for it and I said, you know, there's a chance he might announce Vance as his VP selection, you know, and it's a reasonable way to tee up the RNC the next day. So we drove there, and we had some chaos with our hire car, which meant we left really quite late and got there only about half an hour or so, I think, before it started. And we set up on the side, and we didn't even have access to the, you know, the full press pen, which actually turned out to be an absolute blessing that we weren't penned in. And we set up and we started doing these lives, and then I heard this thing, and you know what it's like living in America. One of the sad things you learn is you identify flipping gunshots.
Mm.
It's something you know the sound of. Mm. And of course, from like 100 yards or whatever it was away, they sound like kind of little tiny cracks, don't they? This is a massive AR-15, which up close would deafen you. With a bit of distance, it sounds like little pops. It sounds much more benign than it really is. And I said, that's gunshots. You know, and we had no idea where they'd come from. I heard about 6 or 8 shots. We hit the deck for a little bit just behind the car, which, you know, all those hostile environment courses say, don't hide behind a car because that won't save you from bullets. There's nothing else. We're in the wide open here. There's literally nothing else. And then there's that moment when you kind of emerge from the shock of it, and I suddenly realized I can't hear him talking anymore. You know, he's gone silent. And then there's another moment where the screaming starts and you know that something really awful has taken place. And then there's the chaos of the lack of information, having no idea what's happened, people running, people coming out. I mean, we went straight on air and were as honest with the audience, because that's the only option, to say, we don't really know. I can tell you what I think's just happened, but I don't really know. And we started grabbing people, and there were, you know, you wouldn't believe the range of emotions of people. Some just really quiet, some absolutely in floods of tears, some really... One guy walked past me and he tapped me on the shoulder while I was on air and said, they shot first, this is war. You know, and you feel this shiver run up your spine. Another guy stood in front of me, between me and the cameraman, while I was on air, and said, you shouldn't be doing this. You know, I did one of the things that, in fact, during that whole night, I did one of the things that I rarely do, which I put my hands on someone, because I thought, you know, they have to know that you're a human being too. Mm. And, you know, persuaded this guy, we have to tell people what's happened, you know, and he could have punched me in the face, but fortunately he stood out of the way.
Gary, everything you've said is about the sound of that day. Mm. You're blind. Mm. You can't see.
Mm.
I find it extraordinary what you do. I've watched you at work, and it amazes me how you manage to do your job. The information flow, a situation like that, when, you know, it's hard enough to know what's happening when you can see, but when you can't see, describe the challenge of that.
Well, I mean, generally speaking, you're right. The information flow is a huge problem when you can't see, because while the technology has come on a long way, so, you know, I can read the New York Times on my phone pretty happily. I can, you know, look at sort of basic news sources. But the volume of information through social media and things like that is incredibly hard. So I spend most of my life paddling furiously under the surface to try and keep up. And I'm never happy with where I am in terms of what I've read, what I've seen, what I know. So I'm constantly relying on other people to tell me stuff. And, you know, we work with smart people who know what I want to know. And so they will tell me when there's something popped up on their notifications or their screen that they can just skim. When you're blind and you read Braille or listen through audio, you can't skim. You can't skim quantities of information like you can when you can see. And that's the biggest drawback. In a live situation like that during the shooting, I mean, in some ways, I was no more of a disadvantage than the people I was with, because, you know, you're on your own little square 3 feet of land, and they don't know very much about, you know, they can't really tell what's going on either. So I felt okay. And the other thing that made me feel okay is that I thrive off live broadcasting like you, and it is, I find, you know, incredibly rewarding. You know, built pieces and having time to write is lovely too, but the live stuff is just incredibly exhilarating. And because I've spent lots of time immersing myself, like you have, in America's past, that gives you something to draw on in those moments. It gives you something to talk about, gives you a sort of connection with the country that you can bring out. And that all comes to mind immediately. And it means you can contextualize in that terrible word, but just talk about it like a human being, as opposed to just being a kind of rat-a-tat-tat reporter.
One of the things that you have done throughout your career is to send the message that whatever your disability, you can still be a frontline foreign correspondent. You can still win awards. You can still be the best at what you do.
That's very nice of you to say. One of the great pleasures I get from my work is the regular sort of contact I get, emails, person to person. I had a bunch of this when I was at an event at the House of Commons the other day. Parents of blind children in particular coming up and saying, thank you for giving us some belief that there is a future for our child in whichever kind of, you know, sphere they end up going into. Because, you know, a lot of parents, even nowadays, and my parents certainly felt it when I was young, they feel completely alone, completely isolated and terrified. You know, blindness is one of those things that everyone fears. It's right up there in the surveys with things like, you know, cancer. It's one of the massive fears people have for themselves and certainly for their family members. And if by just doing what I do day to day, it helps some of those parents with children who can't see and maybe have other disabilities too, think that there can be a future, then I consider that a job done.
We didn't mention the cricket, and that's probably just as well.
Oh, brutal. Oh, dear. Pain and pleasure, you know, cricket, as it always is. All those cliches, the hope that kills you and all that kind of thing. But we fight on. I'm heading to Adelaide next week, and I have belief.
Gary O'Donoghue, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
It's a great pleasure. Lovely to see you again.
Oh, that's Gary O'Donoghue, the BBC's chief North America correspondent. I love the anecdote about the secession ringtone.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.